If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Monday, the best night of the week. That means it's time for another episode of RFRX, your prescription for coping. I'm your host, Kara, and I have with me returning co-host and favorite skeptic and Wikipedia police.
No, no.
Rob Palmer. Welcome,
that's a little
Rob.
Bit too much power. Thank
too much.
You. Glad to be here again.
Glad to have you back, and I love your background. It's very on
theme.
That's
actually a photograph my friend took in outside of his house in Fresno last week.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I assume that's a special filter and everything, or?
I didn't ask, but it's amazing just to see a full rainbow. Like, I've only seen a few in my life like that, and both of them were in Hawaii, I think.
Wow, that's incredible. Well done for your friend.
Yeah, see the whole thing again. It's really amazing.
Wow, awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that with us.
And that's thanks to Yahweh for, you know, that's the promise. He's not going to flood the earth again. So there we go.
But it's not a promise that he won't burn it down.
Absolutely not. He's tricky.
Yeah. I remember learning that in school. And we had already gotten to Revelation by that point. I said, hey, wait a minute. But if he's just going to destroy the earth a different way, what good is that promise?
Right.
And I was told to stop asking questions. I get that a lot.
Yeah, too many questions.
Fair point. Well, what else have you been up to lately, Rob?
Oh, me. I actually had a busy week. I actually, in my ambassador position for RFR, I hadn't done one in a while, but I did a podcast. And it was in India. So that was really interesting. I got to learn as much as I think I was trying to, you know, give information to the podcast host, because we talked a lot about Hinduism and all of their issues. You know, they don't have the same kind of hell, heaven thing as, you know, Christian and Islamic religions, but there are just as equally bad things. And the podcaster not only promotes science, but he tries to push back on bad things regarding Hinduism, like the caste system and stuff like that. So that was fascinating. I also got to interview Dave Warnock, who's been here twice.
Yes, and we need to have him back.
Yeah, so he did an interview for me for the magazine I write for. And I have on the hook for next week, I am going to actually be interviewing God. Well, Mr. Deity.
Close
as I'm ever going to get. So what have you been doing?
Man, nothing quite that exciting. We had our RFR Leadership Summit last weekend, or this past weekend. So I was at that, which was wonderful to get to catch up with all of the fine volunteers and directors and leadership at RFR and hear about all of the really cool things that have been going on around here.
I was too busy on Saturday. I caught the Sunday session, so I missed your talk. And you talked about this, I guess, right?
I did. Yes, I made a PowerPoint and everything. I'll show you later. I think it was recorded, so you'll be able to catch up on it. But yeah, it took a full 2 days to hear reports from all of the different departments and activities that we have going on here, because RFR has been doing a lot. Yeah, so that was wonderful. It's really glad to get to be a part of that. So we'll look forward to the next one being even bigger and better. Without any further ado, Rob, would you like to introduce our guest who needs no introduction, but we're going to introduce him anyway?
Probably doesn't, but because this is going on the podcast and, you know, and up on YouTube, and people might hit this one first, they might not know who David is. So David Tejat is a mental health therapist and photographer focused on and teaching how creativity intersects with mental flexibility. He grew up as a Christian fundamentalist, attending a Bible college, and received a bachelor's in theology and psychology. During his studies there, David deconverted and has been on a journey of appreciating humanity and all the stories we create to build meaning and purpose in our lives. He has a master's in both forensic psychology and counseling psychology, and is currently at work on a doctorate in clinical psychology. David has been actively working within the field of psychology as therapist, social worker, advocate, and subject matter expert for over 15 years. In his spare time, he enjoys reading a copious amount of both fiction, nonfiction, exploring perspectives through photography. I don't even know what that means. And maintains a blog at lifeweavings.com and a podcast at humanitiesvalues.com. So because we're going to be talking about Buddhism tonight, in preparation for tonight's talk, I called out for a takeout order for dinner, and I asked for a sub sandwich, and I told them to make me one with everything. So on to you, David.
Classic. Classic.
How to do it.
It begs for that joke. It does. Yes, so we're going to be looking at Buddhism today. We'll say that if you're here looking for like a Wikipedia entry, that will not be what this is. I will note immediately that I do not refer to myself as an expert in Buddhism. It is something that I've been looking at off and on for, is it kind of like, you know, for everybody who's rational pre deconversion, like everybody goes through an Ayn Rand period, and then after deconversion, like everybody goes through a Buddhist period, like you're just trying to figure, I don't know. So anyway, I went through that. But it just kind of, you know, comes and goes. And actually in preparation for this, definitely back into it. There's a lot of things that I was finding. I'm like, I had no idea that I'd incorporated so much of this into my thinking. Wiccan pagan. Well, I mean, really, I consider the source, I'm not surprised, Miss J. So yeah. Miss J. Totally calling you that now.
Yeah.
That works. Anyway. So actually I want to go to the polls initially, which thank you everybody for having fun with that. No, this will not be about Jordan Peterson. In fact, I will not even be quoting him.
Thank goodness for small miracles.
If you do, please try to impersonate him with the Kermit the Frog voice. I'd love that.
No. It was actually interesting why, and a reason why I start here is that one, it was really interesting actually. I was not expecting some of the numbers on these. And so it's just always fascinating to see what's going on. And so part of it is, of course, how things are framed. Like anybody who does is research polls at all knows that often the polling question itself will indicate both the bias of the poll list, but also, you know, where they're wanting to go. This is one reason why I love answering polls from Fox News, because, you know, they're always like specifically in a direction.
Is Trump the greatest president that ever was, or is he the best president?
Yeah, like yes, absolutely yes. Yes, times infinity. I mean, it's fantastic. So there's a lot there. You know, one reason, in fact, what we're going to start off with here is if anybody's referring, is aware of Ninian Smart. He was a Scottish philosopher and psychologist, studied psychology and religion. And he had come up with this idea of the seven dimensions of religion. And so we'll actually be looking at that initially. And this is like 30, 40 years ago. I think his books are no longer fully in print. I've found one and have ordered it because clearly I need more books. There's also a Wikipedia entry that goes into some of his thinking there. We can share if we want. But part of this goes into, like, for instance, two people out of 35 mentioned that, you know, Buddhism as a religion is like all religions should be dismissed. Like, yes, true. Okay, interesting. This question very much is about how one considers and looks at religion, and whether or not religion is this kind of monolithic entity, whether or not, you know, they're pretty much all, you know, either one, they're all bad because they're trying to dissuade us from a humanistic perspective, or they're all potentially good because they're all trying to answer, you know, basic questions. You know, can you go from, you know, basically two sides of the spectrum here?
Are you going to go into what the difference between a philosophy and religion? Because I recall watching live many years ago when Bill O'Reilly came back at somebody mm-hmm. and said, no, Christianity is not a religion, it's a philosophy. And it's like, what?
Right. No, it's a personal relationship with Jesus.
Of all the people, Bill O'Reilly, to even use the term philosophy is, that hurts here somewhere. Actually, I thought you were going to say Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. And in fact, the reason why some of these phrases get used will actually be touched on through the seven dimensions. So it's a fascinating way of looking at things. I'd never encountered it before. I have no idea how I stumbled across it. I do. It was in relationship to, as mentioned in Buddhism, a very short introduction. If anybody's heard me before, I've mentioned the very short introduction series often. In fact, they're all right here on this shelf.
I was about to say, aren't we seeing some of them now? I spy.
Yeah, there's like 50 out of the 600 or so that are there. They're just a fantastic series and well worth exploring. One of these days, I'll be able to get money the more often I mention it, but that day is not today. So it's a great one. And he actually mentions the Professor Cohen. Kion, I'm going to butcher his name, I'm sure, smarts thing. So it was pretty interesting to go through. And so, of course, that goes into the second one, myths or lies have no place in rational contemplation. Wow, that leaped up. When I first saw it, it was one person said yes, and we were at eight. So consider the audience, I guess. Rather fun. Want to pick and choose what myths to explore. So we'll go into a bit of what myths are and what they are not, and the assumptions that we often bring to them, which will, if you want the tailor-made person about assumptions concerning myths, that would be JP. So, looked into Buddhism before, find it intriguing, rather fun that there was 13 that said yes. And there are actually three of you. This was zero before when I first looked. If I was forced to pick a religion, this is the one I pick. So fun. Let's see. I had to put this one on here. Why, and I'm tired of Buddhism being brought up by atheists. I've heard it stated a few times. Like, really? Everybody's just going after this. And there is a lot of overlap with Stoicism. There absolutely is. So, which is fascinating as to why that might be. Won't go into that very much, but while we're studying and exploring, all of you kind of sociological archaeologists out there, explore that. And then the
I'll
last
try
one
not
is
to get
just
too
a silly
excited.
One. Yeah. the last resist. One is just. I mean, because I couldn't, I love all of the superhero movies. So I'm just, get my nerd on. Let's see what happens.
Now, I'm going to need you to explain this one to me. I'm being a bad nerd at the moment.
That's actually two of us, Kara. Yeah, I'm pretty much up on this, and I don't know who those two people are.
Yeah, what is happening that we need to know about here?
Well, because it's DC and not Marvel.
Yeah.
Shots fired.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So DC has been taken over by or been given over to the movie franchise to James Gunn and Peter Safran to basically create a metaverse, much like the Marvel universe has been creating MCU, because they finally looked around 10 years too late, probably, and went, oh, my God, we're not making nearly as much money as the MCU. And maybe we should have a coherent idea of how to put all these movies together. And so they were given to these two guys, which would be really interesting to see where they go with things. But yes, there's a lot of controversy because Henry Cavill, so delicious, is no longer Superman. Yeah, he's also no longer the Witcher. I mean,
Yeah, how did that happen? I am sad about that. Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I thought that maybe Gunn and Saffron were characters that you were shipping from some kind of like fan fiction archive.
I'm sure there's some kind of fan fiction out there about it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I said that one time about a different show that I was talking to some friends about, and years later, I still haven't gotten to the end of the list of fan fictions of Supernatural. Turns out that's a whole thing.
That's a whole thing, and I loved every season. Oh, beautiful. Yeah. So,
I did too.
Anyway,
and I don't normally like a season of anything for 15 seasons unless it's Star Trek.
It's true. Yeah. So if anybody wants to nerd out even more, I will totally be hanging out afterwards, so we can, you know, nerd out to our heart's content. So returning to the actual topic that we're looking at, and interesting, I will come back to that question. So when it comes to questions, anybody who's seen me present before knows that I kind of fly by the seat of my pants a bit. And largely because I like to respond to questions as they go and make this as organic as possible. So if there are questions that I see pop up in the chat that I think are pertinent to the immediate moment, I will attempt to address them. If not, definitely we will be keeping track of them and we'll look at them at the end. yeah, we'll get into reincarnation a bit. It is and isn't a Buddhist idea, so it's a little peculiar. Yeah, in fact, one of the media difficulties when looking at Buddhism is that it's really more of Buddhisms, because, you know, one, you have the two central or main schools of Mahayana and Theravada, but as well, you then have the Japanese version, which there are like two or three versions there, including Zen. There's the Tibetan Tantric version. You know, there's a lot of different things that happen, largely because, for two reasons. One, when Siddhartha Gautama, who is referred to as Buddha, or initially just great teacher, but when he taught what he did, he left without any kind of authoritative writings. He didn't say, this is the only way, kind of thing. And so as a consequence, he left it up to his followers. Like, this is about your own personal exploration. Go forth and, you know, multiply. So, and they did, because humankind is, if it's anything, it is a faction one. So we love creating our groups and then, you know, telling the other groups that we're better than they are. So it's just, we love it. And so, you know, so one, it was that. And then two, historically, Buddhism has a tendency, contradiction to like Christianity and Islam, that when they enter into a new land, they tend to just simply incorporate a lot of the ideas. Even parallel, like, it's really not a big surprise to walk into a village that Hindu, you know, the Buddhists come into and go, sure, ancestor worship, and then, oh, go to the monk here for, you know, wisdom about you know, your, you know, longevity in life or whatever. I mean, it's just, it's not a problem, because, you know, so much of it has to do with one's personal, you know, journey and you know, towards enlightenment. So it's so because of those two things, everything kind of blew up, and we've got, you know, factions everywhere. And so, which is where a lot of it comes into, like, for instance, you know, reincarnation earlier was mentioned, and which it is and isn't within Buddhism. So, you know, there are certain ideas that we generally think of as, oh, this is Buddhism. And it's more closely aligned with Mahayana as opposed to the Theravada branch, which we'll get into a little bit of what those differences are. But coming back a little bit, so Ninian Smart wanted to have an, you know, exploration of basically the meaning-making process that human beings engage in that manifest, at least in this way, through religious lenses. And so in the way that both he, several others, myself actually as well, you know, look at religion is actually as a, it's not a thing in itself. It's not like it got, you know, spontaneously erupted and emerged out of something. It's a active participatory engagement with reality as a way of helping make sense of, you know, our existence, albeit within the constant limited information that we all have. So in a sense, religion is like a science. It's on a trajectory of limited information and trying to make sense of what we, you know, think about ethically. What do we think about meaning and purpose? And how do we make sense of why do things happen the way they do? Now, granted, the information was even more limited. And in fact, there is a, I totally forget the guy's name, so we'll have to look it up. But the book was titled From Religion to Philosophy. And it was basically an exploration of how religion started as an initial way of answering inquiry and eventually moved into philosophy, which eventually, you know, led us into science. Because
is it F.M. Cornford?
Process.
Oh, sorry.
Maybe. Yeah. Okay. It wouldn't surprise me if it's, if there's several of the same title kind of thing, but,
okay.
But it's a way of looking at this. There's some questions as to whether or not this is really how that thing, how that worked, but I find it a helpful way of looking at how we tend to, you know, view things, in the trajectory of human knowledge. But, so in a sense, everything we're, so anytime that you're looking at a religion, is that you can initially look at it from the perspective of it is an attempt at creating a sense of meaning and understanding about one's existence and role in life and so on, which welcome to all of us. We've all got big old fat question marks as to what the hell we're doing. And they're, all of them are various attempts at trying to figure all that out to varying degrees of success. and in fact, you know, so, and this goes into, so about what they are and why, where are the similarities, what are the differences, and how to analyze them as parts of a whole rather than, you know, whole things in themselves. So broke it into, like, there's the practical and ritual part of religions. You know, there's, you know, the things that we do in order to generate a particular type of meaning. There's the experiential or emotional component. You know, so Rudolf Otto referred to this as, you know, the numinous, which is, you know, it's an idea there, well worth studying his writing on that. You know, the conversion of Apostle Paul. I mean, it's an experiential part. It also tends to dovetail into the mythic, which we'll get into that in, here in a second.
Wait, what was the thing you said?
Also.
Right before the conversion of John, what was that?
Oh. The idea of the numinous, the Rudolf Otto was a philosopher who explored that.
Numinous.
There we go. So definitely worth, you know, taking a look at. It's just an interesting thing to, like, well, okay. And these things tend to dovetail into the third category, which is the mythic or narrative portion. You know, so it's, you know, it's where we often will go to when understanding religions. We'll go immediately to the stories that they share, and then often then writ large, like, oh, this is all that it is. Maybe it doesn't have to be. For instance, one of my favorite examples is Catholicism, you know, because there are a number of people out there that are full-on agnostic or atheist, who still attend Catholic Church, who still engage in a lot of the rituals for it, not because they agree with the myths behind it, not necessarily that they agree certainly with the doctrines behind them, but they appreciate what the rituals are attempting to do, how they bring people together. They'll look at it from a very broader perspective of how you can create meanings to it. So we get into this whole thing around how when we start looking at these various ways of looking at religion, it's very easy to just go, well, you know, this ends up being effectively, see atheists and do this humanists all the time, where it's like, you call yourself this name, but you don't agree with certain aspects of it. Therefore, you're not actually a real believer in this. And
the no thing true of it is that, fallacy specifically.
Right. Which is hilarious because that's exactly what the various sects of that religion are often doing to one another. So all we're doing is perpetuating the, frankly, bullshit of that there is this monolithic version that has never changed, and there's never been any various iterations throughout history. And the thing is, we know better. Christianity, for instance, clearly has never had a single line of, doctrine. It has been all over the map.
I get two flavors of callers on the helpline. Most of them are my religion, my little piece of Christianity specifically, is the only correct one. But there have been a number of people who did not know there were other versions or other, as you're saying, evolutionary changes. No, it's always been this way. Everyone who's a Christian believes what I believe. That shocked me.
Yeah. Yep. And that's and good. We should, in fact, if anything, we should be encouraging that. We should be encouraging anybody we come across who is going, there are various ways of looking at this. The monolithic thing is what we don't want. In fact, when I get to the end here, basically three principles that I'm deriving from studying Buddhism here that then can be really helpful in not only mental health, but personal endeavors and so on. And one of them alludes to that idea that there is some singularity to any particular group and or ideology rather. And the more we in fact encourage people to go, oh, there's actually been a lot of different iterations of this, and this people over here did this, the better we get at diminishing the power of any of a particular version to become ascendant. It's like what we have in fact is in here is almost like a push for a small degree of partisanship when it comes to ideologies. Like, we want the competition. We want people to be sitting around going, well, maybe kind of this, maybe over there, because where we get these, a lot of the problems is when a single form or version, I mean, we have the kind of a monopolistic social perspective on ideology, and that never helps. Like, history is replete with examples of when there's a singular idea that, or version of an idea that gains ascendancy, it never really turns out very well. Because again, we're humans, and when we don't have much in the way of competition with our ideas, we tend to be assholes about it.
Can't grow and change. If you think that you have the one true belief that's always been this way and it can never change, then you can't ever change your mind on anything. If you meet somebody that challenges your perspective, or if you learn new information, what are you going to do with that? You're going to have cognitive dissonance, I guess, forever.
So this goes, I love you bringing it up, because this goes into, cognitive dissonance, which I've actually presented on before. Is actually, I take it as less of a negative and more of a positive. Not only one, because I think our brains are constantly in a dissonant state. In fact, most of the time what we're doing is engaging in behavior to avoid that dissonance. But in fact, the dissonance is where creativity occurs. The dissonance is where we recognize the probabilistic nature of all knowledge and go, even if we're, 99.9% sure, that this one particular thing in a particular context is true, there may very well come upon, some other, point down the road that goes, so it's one of the things I work with pretty much all my clients is not only from an acceptance commitment therapy perspective of holding thoughts lightly, but is to basically acknowledge that literally everything we do and say and think is to some degree inaccurate or wrong. Now, it could be a small degree, could be a huge degree. We don't know. But the more we sit there with the acceptance of, I'm probably missing something, because you are. We literally can't hold everything at any single conscious state. So the more we hold that in kind of like, let's see what's possible. It does not mean, to throw out the caveat, this does not mean some kind of subjectivism. This does not mean the truth doesn't matter. Or anything like that. It just means the capital T truth, the absolutism that of which we are all prone to, not just, those who are involved in religion, is something that we need to constantly be working against. And so, and that's part of where Nene and Smith's, the seven dimensions help us with this, because we can look at, for instance, how the personal or the experiential will often dovetail into the mythic, which itself will then dovetail and be reciprocally related to rituals, which then can be tied into institutions as well, and go, okay, so why do I have a problem, for instance, with a particular doctrine? Well, yeah, there is part of what it says, but it also is because it relates back to as well how we create our institutions, how we create our social connections. The doctrine, for instance, it's like you mentioned earlier, the LGBTQ, plus group, and for RFR, and going, the reason why the doctrines that have been created around being anti various, sexual proclivities is wrong, is not just the doctrine itself. It's the ramifications of what it has in social and ethical practice. So it's not just simply some kind of detached philosophy. It has a connection to, which is where we get at times into some of the discussions we can have with people, is if we start and end only with the doctrines, which I see a lot of people doing. I used to do it myself, particularly when I first got out of Christianity. It was like, there's these issues with the Bible, as if there's one version. And it's like, and this is a contradiction here, this is a contradiction there. And it's like, it's a waste of freaking time, because, or the old question of, did Jesus exist? I mean, to all power to those who have dedicated their entire, educational lives to figuring that question out. But I just don't care. Because whether or not such a person existed is secondary to how that person's, the stories, the myths that have emerged out of it, have been used in conjunction with them, generating particular experiential moments that then, generate particular doctrines that then generate, social things. You see where, like, as we break these things down, we have a greater degree of being able to have a conversation, and not only where we might actually find some kind of commonality, but further where we also will then be able to have the chinks within the armor of one's belief, where we can eventually go, oh, maybe I'm not as right as I thought. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a win. I don't care whether you start religious or otherwise. Like, any time we get to the point of being able to say, I don't know, and I'm actually okay. saying that I don't know is a win for humanity, for that matter.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like that, you know, for a lot of people is what is so comforting sometimes about sticking to a particular belief system, especially if it is really heavy on the doctrine and understanding that this is 100% true. You don't have to do the uncomfortable work of thinking that you might be wrong, which is uncomfortable. Like, nobody wants to be wrong. And I feel right. like, I mean, I don't like it. It happens to me all the time and it's terrible. But that's how we learn things.
Yep. And well, I like the expression surrounding that being wrong feels exactly like being right because you don't know it.
Yep. You don't. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that and the feeling about it. I mean, this is Catherine Schulz's book, Being Wrong, Adventures on the Margin of Error. Highly recommend. I think I've probably mentioned it often. But, you know, she mentioned it because the feeling of being wrong is a lot like the feeling of being right, because you're like, man, I was right about being wrong. I mean, there's still that confirmation, because any belief that we have, and I do promise this does tie immediately back into Buddhism here, is that any belief we have is not just some kind of like mental firing. It's a way of relating us to and within reality as we know it. So it's one of the things we work with a lot of people on, like, for instance, boundaries. We often will consider boundaries as some kind of wall that we put up in order to keep, you know, things from happening to us. And on the contrary, actually look at boundaries as the behaviors, both, you know, intellectual and active, that we do to define the relationships that we're in all their various kinds. So boundaries are the ideas we hold about ethics. They are the ideas we hold about our own sexuality and identity. They are also the behaviors that we do when we define whether or not a person's a friend, an intimate partner, a family member, a coworker, and so on. These variations in how we relate to one another are the boundaries saying, oh, this is who we are together. And so as we explore these things, you know, the beliefs are not just simply some mental thing. They are the means through which people are understanding reality, which is, again, why people get rather upset when, you know, you start attacking them or having issues around being wrong, because it's never just some kind of intellectual exercise. It is always about something more than that. It's survival from a, you know, psychological perspective. And in fact, part of this is actually what the Buddha mentioned and talked about. You know, so he went through this notion of that, let's see if I can create. Yeah, so Stephen Batchelor, who was a ordained monk, he actually did a lot of translation work for the Dalai Lama. Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist is amazing. Buddhism Without Beliefs was the first book I ever read of his, that just stellar reflection. And he, you know, through the process of a lot of the translations that he was doing and a lot of the work that he was doing. So understand, when we look at translations, it's also for Buddhists, translations, doing the translation exercise here is not just some academic exercise. It is a spiritual discipline. It is a way of communing with, you know, the way of viewing the world. So though, you know, so those who engage in interpretation is not necessarily a calling, quite do that, but it is something that is highly revered. So when you're, so for him to do this, his bona fides are well established. But in the process of doing a lot of these interpretations, a lot of the translations, a lot of, you know, the study and contemplation that he did, eventually he kind of did a Thomas Jefferson on Buddhism, where he just kind of got rid of all of the supernatural elements that had creeped in over the hundreds of years since Buddha, and went, wait a minute, let's try to get as close to what, you know, he was talking about, and, you know, excise a lot of this excess and see what remains. And that's where you get Buddhism Without Beliefs, where he works through a lot of those ideas. I have heard of Mark Uro. Definitely, he's a great advocate, good person to read. We'll get into a list of all the books later. If anybody has seen me present before, you have about a dozen after every time I'm done of things to read. So, look me up.
Following
on Goodreads.
You now on Goodreads.
I know. I saw. It's funny.
Yes, I'm constantly inspired to get my reading caught up when I see you've read, like, you know, 8 books in a week or something.
Yeah, a lot of their fiction, but still. So did the concept of hells exist? So this is one of those where it didn't at the beginning. So here's where we get into some of the basic split between Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism. And the Mahayana tradition basically went down the path of saying, you know, what the Buddha, what Gautama, you know, said at the beginning was the kind of initial revelation, to use a Western idea here. And you know, the initial Dharma that was being shared, it wasn't complete. He was kind of like a parent who was, you know, saying things simplistically to his children. And so miraculously, of course, those who are espousing this idea then say, but we have the second turning of that wheel, so you have to listen to us. How convenient. So you have an entire tradition then that spun off of that. This is where you get into the sutras. You know, one of the most popular ones, the Lotus Sutra, where, you know, so you have these kind of extra ideas that have been added on. And so the notion of, if anybody's aware of or have heard the term bodhisattva, that comes out of the Mahayana tradition. So bodhisattvas are teachers that have dedicated themselves to actively continuing in the reincarnation path in order to continue leading people to nirvana, even as they themselves are not going there yet. So it got to the point where they the bodhisattvas were lauded even more than Gautama himself. Excellent referral to Alan Watts. He is phenomenal to listen to. Definitely more of the Zen Buddhist tradition, and which is, of course, it's almost like I post the question to myself. Cones are where you get in with Zen Buddhism, which is more Japanese. In fact, there could be an entire study, in fact, I'm sure there are, on how the various subculture or various cultures that Buddhism went into shifted and manifested various forms of Buddhism in it. So for instance, the kind of original Buddhism that is related more towards Theravada, and they, you know, is what's more individualistic, you know, the idea of you work out your own kind of, I'm going to use the term salvation, not quite what would be referred to, but you work out your own individual path to the end of suffering or nirvana. And whereas Zen went into more of a communal, they focused on social connections, which, unsurprisingly, came out of Japan. Much more of a communal society, much more an idea of taking care of, you know, the people next to you, taking care of your family, and so on. So it's just a fascinating way of, and again, why we come back to, and why it can be really helpful to look at these, you know, any religion, including Buddhism, through these seven dimensions, because it allows us to be able to parse out and go, oh, why was, you know, this developed? You know, quite often, if not almost always, it's never for the explicit purpose of control. People will use it, obviously, because anybody who's in power wants to keep it. And so they'll use whatever tools available. But often it was developed precisely to address a particular cultural aspect that it was evolving out of. And so, and then it's gone down through, you know, the ages that, you know, where we're like, oh, well, now what do we do with it? So a lot of different things there. But fundamentally, you know, so have the idea here of, and what Batchelor referred to is the, he actually draws from Martin Heidegger, and which is a European philosopher, and he refers to how being in the world, what the Buddha referred to, I'm going to get the exact phrasing wrong here for a second, but what he referred to as being the presence in the moment. You know, it's this kind of co-occurring process that as we develop our ideas, as we engage in reality, we are being shaped by the context in which we are in, while also shaping it. And there was this notion of a non-separation, which for people who are, you know, somewhat you know, familiar, the idea of a no mind notion here is a direct derivation from this. You know, if there is no separation at a certain level, then there is no self. There is no singular thing that is you, because you are constantly being developed in your, you know, through your experience, and not only experience, but the stories you have about it. You know, anybody who's, you know, listening here, it's like, you know, Kara included, like, we look back at some of our own deconversion stories and how often the initial story we had, you know, how, what is it? It's like, not only does everybody go through like an Ayn Rand period, but everybody goes through like a really pissed off period post-conversion. And, you know, it's like the stories we have are like, you know, screw this, I was wronged, and, you know, I want to burn it all down. And to some degree, it might be just simply repeating what I thought. But anyway, you know, it's like, yeah, we go through this period of like just really being upset. And so, and yet as we, hopefully, as we move on and try out new ideas and mature, or mature very lightly, you know, we hope to get to, you know, out the other end of it going, yes, the angry atheist faith. You know, it's like, we hope to get past enough to then being able to say, oh, I understand better why I believed at the time. That, you know, understand why, for instance, say, you know, parents, you know, brought me to church, or, you know, why they, you know, enforce this. It wasn't often, sometimes, admittedly, it wasn't because you're just awful people or wanting to spread a lie. Quite the opposite. You literally think it's true. So, of course, if you think that something, your ideology is not only true, but it's the path to salvation that will, you know, keep you from eternal damnation, of course you're going to share it. How awful would you be if you didn't? Like, it's just, it would make no sense not to share something that was believed to be so, you know, viscerally, you know, accurate. And so it's not, again, that we have to agree with any of it, but eventually we get to this idea of, oh, right, okay, there's a little bit more nuance to this. I can soften my way of how I view myself, perhaps. I can soften my way of how I view maybe perhaps some of the people in my life, my past. And so we move on a little bit. That is a different story from the anger period. And notice the behaviors shift as these stories develop. You know, we're not, you know, hanging out in, you know, in chat rooms, haranguing, you know, the believers anytime we want, and taking pride in getting kicked out of, you know, various groups, you know, instead.
You're very optimistic, like, oh, David.
I mean,
you see the best in people.
You try. Yeah.
I want to ask you about the opposite side of this, David. I've had this conversation with people on the helpline, and it kind of happened with my own family when they all converted to evangelical Christianity. You know, initially they're on your ass to save you, right? Because as you said, what kind of, you know, family would they be if they didn't do that? Then eventually they take the hint it's not working and they totally drop you like a hot potato and back off. So that's a little weird. If they really believe your family one is going to hell forever and be tortured, okay, I'm done with you, goodbye. Like, that doesn't seem right either. One could possibly get angry at that.
Good. Well, and so what's interesting there is that now we have a kind of experiential, example of what emphasis people put on the various aspects of their religious ideology. You know, we know the people who, for instance, like I mentioned before near the beginning, where call themselves, you know, Roman Catholic, and yet no, a lot of this is myth. A lot of this is more, you know, some contemplative practice. In fact, there's been a rise in Christianity in general in the contemplative traditions, going back all the way to Erasmus, and very different. Anybody who's ever, Miss. I'm gonna blank on the name, but Carolyn Miss, where, you know, it's nothing more. I mean, it's still Christianity, but it's clear it's Christianity that is detached from most of the doctrines that we tend to associate with, and it's almost entirely about finding some kind of subjective peace within your own spiritual enlightenment. I'm not saying I agree with any of that, but it's a fascinating exploration of, like, when you focus almost exclusively on the experiential part of a religious ideology, where do you run with this? You know, if you focus almost exclusively on, you know, a particular doctrine, you know, I like to say that I can pretty much get along with most believers of any ideology so long as they're not, you know, strict doctrinal fundamentalists, because once you've focused so exclusively on words and their particular phrasing, there's not a whole lot of room to, you know, have a conversation. You know, it's just like, well, this is the only way I can, you know, do this. You know, it's where, in fact, recent example, a lot of Islam, for instance, there was a big kerfuffle over, I'm forgetting the college, but it was an art class where the professor shared a artistic rendering of Muhammad. Had told people ahead of time, this is what's going to happen. The artist was in fact a Muslim, was asked hundreds of years ago when he was asked he was commissioned by a Muslim prince. Like everything was going on, and yet you had a small group of people who decided to make a protest out of it and say, this is going to trigger, you know, Muslims in the class because of the problems of not depicting, you know, Muhammad, and so on and so forth. And what was missed in all of the coverage of this, well, a lot of the coverage of this, was that it's a minority opinion. this whole notion that you're not supposed to share images was not only one, not a doctrine in Islam at the beginning, it developed much later, but two, it's not even shared by all Muslims everywhere. So what we're doing in this coverage and in exploration of this was essentially allowing this small group, and who knows even what they were actually after, being little shits, but you know, it's like they're just, you know, wanting to do this, and we're allowing them to paint an entire group on one ideological focus, which is only going to encourage further absolutist thought and reaction. That in fact, the coverage itself ended up not allowing for the creativity, the notion of pluralism within, you know, ideological structures to exist, which is exactly where we need if we're going to be able to have room for dialogue and allow people to have various behavioral, you know, changes. So it's just another example of like, when we catch ourselves going, all fill in the blank believe this, I can almost guarantee you that that is not true. It's just not. So you might be able to say a very particular group does, but that you can say about anybody. You know, of course, you know, the Westboro Baptist, you know, group, which even then calling a group is a bit of a misnomer because it's just basically all one very weirdly connected family. You know, it's like using them to say, well, this is what Christianity believes. Talk about the lowest hanging fruit on the tree here. This is really not helpful.
It's not. And that, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's one of the things that really bugs me sometimes with like people trying to almost do this virtue signaling act of saying, I went and read an article about this other group of people, and now I know all about them, and I'm going to respect their beliefs and do this and that. And it's so close to just making a mockery, you know, of the people that you're claiming to be respecting, because it's so lacking in nuance, and it's almost just like creating a stereotype all over again. You don't mean to be doing that, but it is what is happening, I think, in a lot of cases. And yeah, we really should be more careful about that.
You think so? Yeah, it's ideological tokenism is really what it is. I mean, it's not helpful. It's not helpful when we have our one black friend or one gay friend. Like, oh my God. Like, no, you don't speak for the whole, like, one, your skin color, your sexual orientation literally has no actual connection to what you should or shouldn't believe. So this is, you know, it's absurd. I always love going into groups like, oh, here's my, you know, gay Trump supporting, you know, friend. You know, this is like, she's just like, what? Like, your brain just kind of split in two. And it's like, well, you know, I don't have to agree with one aspect, even as I can appreciate the other and go, wow, this doesn't make any sense to my head. But now we have something to talk about. Like, how does this work? You know, just as we split together, like, what is a person focusing on that is so important to them? You know, for instance, like in the seven dimensions, and all of these can be broken down into other beliefs as well. And in fact, so this is, and I will see, I'm going to come back finally to the being in the world point. And but I actually went on to note how, you know, being in the world means that I am inextricably knit into the fabric of this fluid, indivisible, and contingent reality I share with others. There is no room for a disembodied mind or soul, however subtle, to float free from this condition, to contemplate it from a hypothetical Archimedean point outside. Without such a mind or soul, it is hard to conceive of anything that will go on into another life once this one comes to an end. My actions, like the words of dead philosophers, may continue to reverberate and bear fruits long after my death, but I will not be around to witness them. And it's this co-creative relationship that we have. And this is, you know, where we get into fundamentally, it's like, you know, we get into the description that I had written for, you know, this presentation, and went into the, you know, the idea of, wow, Buddhism isn't quite a religion, it's a philosophy. And which is actually an idea that I will often have often, you know, spouted, thinking I was really smart. And, you know, and the reality is it is a religion, but it's also a philosophy, and it's also an ethic. And if we wanted to bring in, you know, this to a singular point, then the ethic of it is at the corner, is at the foundation of what, you know, Siddhartha wanted, you know, to explore. Because when we get into, say, the Four Noble Truths, when we get into the path of what it means to work away from suffering, away from, kind of malignant joining with reality, when we're working away from that and go down, you know, the Eightfold Path, he's referring to this notion of as you create, so you are bringing about. And so, which is actually one of the lessons that got reconnected again, I think, with me in looking at this, is this profound notion of what it means to engage in a particular ethical, you know, life and how we relate to one another. And so in the idea then behind this was to, you know, so the idea of, for instance, craving, what, you know, the Sanskrit was referred to as tana, was, I didn't memorize that. I actually have notes. So, you know, the second truth of the Four Noble Truths was around this state of arising in the sense of this state of connection that we keep having and can't seem to get rid of. And that's part of what this process within Buddhism was attempting to do, was to actually separate that process so we could go, huh, not tied to this one thing. I'm not tied to this, you know, particular geography. I'm not tied to this particular characteristic. I'm not, holistically defined by, you know, a particular label. That as I remove myself from these things, as I recognize that as a condition, that they are ephemeral, that I can create a more, you know, coherent and ethical and peaceful, you know, life by, you know, ceasing these relationships that I'm having. Of course, I'm using the term relationship broadly. This does not mean some ascetic thing where you go off into a, you know, cave and ignore everybody in the whole world. In fact, if anything, that was actually part of the story of Gautama, where he tried it and eventually realized this is silly, and stopped it, because the whole notion of denying everything was just not helpful at all.
Yes, somebody asked in the chat earlier about that, you know, can you take it too far? How do you not become attached to not being attached?
Yes. Well, and, you know, the non-attachment is an interesting, you know, one, because we're using a Western term there, and which is, and it's often been, you know, you, at this point now, there's so much pop psych around, you know, what attachment style are you? And, you know, and which is not at all how it was intended. But, you know, we have this notion of, you know, non-attachment, meaning that they're, you know, it's non-caring, which is not at all. If anything, it was quite the opposite. It was the acknowledgement that one can care even as you acknowledge that this too will pass, that I can care about this person, for instance, in front of me, even as I hold the space for the acknowledgement that each and every moment they are effectively dying into and fulfilling the next, you know, almost like a quantum collapse. You know, we're, you know, we are constantly evolving into this next state of being if we only will, you know, reflectively consider it strong enough to be able to see, oh, I see where I've come from. Here's where I'm at. Here's where I would like to go. Even if I don't always know what that might be. And being able to care for somebody in such a way to allow for that space for that person to change, to express it, like, how amazing is that? I mean, there is the idea of, for that matter, forgiveness.
So it kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier, then, about holding things lightly, where if you're holding something lightly, then you can also hold perhaps two contradictory things at once, rather than being so laser focused on one thing that you can't see any other possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got it.
Well, and we've all, you know, how often have we, any of us, considered, you know, or made the statement of, I'm just fill in the blank, usually a negative, you know, I can only do this, you know, and there we are attaching ourselves to a singularity that is not actually true. Not only is it not true in its descriptive power, but it's not true even in reality. Like, there is no particular principle that is going to allow for no change whatsoever for all time. Like, it's just not going to be able to do that. And so to hold ourselves accountable to a very particular way of viewing ourselves, particularly if we do so through a characteristic of which we had no power over, i.e. sexual orientation, race, skin color, whatever, hair color, lack thereof. Like, I mean, it's just like, what are you, there's no reason to hold oneself to this singular, you know, form. And so a lot of this goes to then, you know, certain principles that can come out of it, which is, you know, mentioned before already, you know, looking at the time, of ethics being an attempt at creating a transcendent structure for one's place in the universe. An attempt, not a solution. It's an attempt. So as we consider how we relate to one another, you know, being able to look at how we do so through the lens of, we are not just simply figuring out how I relate, but what world I'm trying to create. Step outside of just this and see this. Look around and consider, where are the ripple effects to this, of what we're doing? You know, it's very similar to, you know, Kant's categorical imperative. You know, it's, you know, if you can run this all the way and make it universal, is it still something that you would still want to apply? And the, so, you know, Keown notes that, you know, these world systems are thought to undergo cycles of evolution and decline lasting billions of years. They refer to them as eons. They come into being, endure for a time, slowly disintegrate before being destroyed in a great cataclysm. In due course, they evolve again to complete a vast cycle known as a great eon. Naturally, the beings who inhabit the physical universes are not affected by these events. And indeed, there is some suggestion that it's the moral status of the inhabitants that determines the fate of the world system. So there is this, you know, and it's a, you know, tie into certain streams of progressivism. There's tie into, for that matter, it's also a principle in a lot of, you know, basic conservative thought, that as you act, so you are creating the world you're stepping into. It's why legislating morality has been such a strong impetus for so long, because they're effectively declaring, if I say this, this is what is going to make the world be. I mean, it's the constant joke of, you know, I was seeing a post on Facebook the other day around, you know, it's like, Jesus came back, you know, came one time as a savior. He's going to come back as a conquering, you know, conqueror later. And please, you know, make it be. Of course, they've been saying this for 2,000 years. Of course, they're always right. But, you know, it's just, but the action there, I mean, the entire doctrine, for instance, of, you know, postmillennialism is based on the idea of, you have created enough of a heaven on earth through the taking over by Christian believers that Jesus goes, ah, thank you. I, you know, come in now. You know, and so it's literally there, this, this notion of what we are instantiating is what we are then, you know, building. So there's this relationship that we're constantly having with reality itself.
And I take and it so, you don't mean Gen Z when you say post-millennialism.
No.
No?
Oh, you know, it took me a half second there to figure out what you'd done. Wow. Caffeine must be wearing off. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's all I got. You know, I didn't have any more puns at the moment, but, you know.
It's pretty close.
Close as I could get.
Want to return real quick. There's a comment about, seems a central tenet of Buddhism is the cessation of suffering is possible, but it isn't true. Therefore, as nice as it seems, it's delusional thought system that causes harm. So here's the one caveat. Siddhartha himself actually noted that he really didn't do much in defining what nirvana was and didn't really talk about it a whole lot. In fact, when he was asked to define it more thoroughly, he's like, the point is not to reach this. The point is not to spend all our time contemplating, you know, what this state of existence would be like. You know, it's kind of like, you know, what's the old, Christian thing, where it's so heavenly minded that they were no earthly good. I mean, it basically was making a very similar kind, you know, idea of going, look, you're so focused on the cessation of this that you're ignoring the whole process that is helping us create the world as we, you know, engage in it. And so there is a tendency to, if you take this to an extreme, that it can be very harmful, much the same way for that matter as the sin nature. You know, if you harp on that to the exclusion of most other things, definitely problematic, to put it lightly. You know, same thing around, you know, certain iterations of the term jihad. You know, it's like most religions have ideas, kernels of ones at times, that if you take to an extreme, if you take to a, you know, a certain conclusion and say it's a conclusion, and then ignore everything else that became before it, you're definitely going to have a lot of awful things come out of it, which is going to be the same, you know, true of pretty much anything. I mean, you know, it's one of those where, in fact, this goes into, you know, third principle here that I'm totally stealing from Jonah Goldberg, actually. He's a political writer these days. But he refers to it as Paracelsus's dictum. Paracelsus was a German Renaissance philosopher and chemist. And he was the idea, he coined the idea of like the dose makes the poison. Or as he put it, what is there that is not poison? All things are poison and nothing is without poison. Solely the dose determines that a thing is not a poison. Considering the fact that you can actually get poisoned by water excess, oxygen poisoning is a thing. Like, you can have too much, yes, of a good thing. In fact, you can look it up. There were actually a few people. There were these water drinking whatever exercise. It was a game, and people died.
Yes. Like, I did read about that.
It was a competition. That was the word I was looking for.
Actually, yeah, many, it was a competition. They drink thousands of people die by dihydrogen monoxide death every year.
Exactly. So
yeah, extremism, you know, is bad, is what we're saying.
Yeah. And not only is extremism bad, but I actually want to make a bigger principle behind it, is that when we're discussing ideas, when we're exploring various things, that we avoid focusing exclusively on extreme examples, because it doesn't actually reveal very much of a way of truth. You know, it's like nationalism. You know, as Goldberg puts, like, National, his biggest thing is, he harps on, like, National is like salt. A little bit, kind of nice. Like, let's understand, you know, like, there's certain, you know, good quality behind recognizing a communal, you know, way of looking at one another. Too much of it, yeah, all we have to do is look at World War II. I mean, it's like, really, like, you do, you know, you put too much salt on something, like, yeah, this is a problem. So, but at the same token, we want to, when looking at ideas, we also want to be careful around how we look at them and look at it, go, okay, so this is an interesting idea, kind of like the cessation of suffering. Like, okay, this is really interesting. If I exclusively focus on this, yeah, that could lead me down a path where I'm doing entirely too much avoidance, and here's the problem. So, you know, there's, you know, so one way of you know, avoiding this tendency is, to bring this a little bit full circle, is back to the cognitive dissonance idea, to actively hold multiple ideas in tension, to be able to say, yeah, some of this, I don't entirely know how they work, but perhaps in the friction between them, I might be able to figure out something else, and it'll allow for some other growth to occur. And who knows what'll develop, but could be fun to find out. And to act, to continually do that can be, one, kind of fun, if a little nerve-wracking at times. Because again, we don't like being wrong, and effectively holding multiple ideas in tension is to get used to the idea that we are wrong all the time.
Yeah, that's the tough
that
part.
It is. Yeah. But that's where we get back to, there was a you know, poem, one of the things Buddha mentioned is that no conditions are permanent. No conditions are reliable. Nothing is self. Hold that. No conditions are permanent. By conditions was meant literally all ideas, things, places. No conditions are reliable. Everything changes. Nothing lasts forever, including nothing itself.
They need to hire you to do the morning affirmations on my Headspace app. This sounds very familiar to me. I love that. That's very just kind of, you know, you're going to be okay kind of feeling. And I love that. I just move through the tension, get comfortable with being uncomfortable sometimes. Right. And then that's how you learn. Well, I love that. And we are getting close to the end of our time here. Other than that nugget, which I think is quite good, do you have anything else that you want to leave us with? Any last words or book recommendations before we go to the Q&A?
Always had a list. But
I'll drop the list,
you know,
in the chat.
You know, one of the books that are awesome. In fact, one of the books on the list that you drop here in a second is Destructive Emotions, which it's part of a series of dialogues between the Dalai Lama and various neuropsychologists, philosophers, and others. That particular one was written by Daniel Goleman, but there's ones on, like, dreaming. There's ones on... it's like three or four. I haven't read all of them. You got it. David's poll questions are cones.
What?
That gives me a lot more credit than is due, but I will totally take it. It's a fantastic book. Just it's an exploration of various ideas, and at least in Buddhism for that, through at least the Dalai Lama's perspective.
Now, is Daniel Goldman, is he the same one that did the Book of Joy as well? The conversation with the Dalai Lama and who was it?
I believe
it?
So.
Yes, it was
maybe
Desmond Tutu, I think. Okay. Oh. I'm sorry. We're having a like nerd moment. Yeah. And he was mentioning in that book, another book that he had done. And I wasn't sure what he was referring to. And I bet it was Destructive Emotions. Okay. I'm going to research that on Goodreads in a minute. To be continued with that one. I'm just going to look on your Goodreads and just copy. Okay. And on that note, let's move to Q&A. Okay. We have collected quite a few questions. I think you have addressed several of them so far. So if I accidentally ask one that you've already covered, we'll just move on. And Rob, feel free to jump in here with me too.
Want to do every other one?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah. And so the first one you have touched on already. I don't know if you want to say any more about it. The question of, you know, is it necessary to believe in reincarnation to be Buddhist? And I think you've kind of told us that there is no one single necessary doctrine. So we'll go on to the next.
Reincarnation wasn't even developed until the 4th or 5th century. I mean, it just kind of like the doctrine of sin. Like it literally didn't even exist until Council of Nicaea. Like, I mean, really, it wasn't something anybody paid attention to until, you know, several hundred years later. So, I mean, yeah.
So somebody asked, and I'm a little confused about this too. The way they put it was how much of Buddhism ties to Hinduism, and I might reverse that too. I'm not even sure which one came first, or am I totally mixing up the genres?
Well, Hinduism had been around for a long time before. So that one definitely came first. Interestingly enough, I mean, Keown in his book goes into, for instance, like eventually the Mahayana version of Buddhism seemed to take on, allusions to Christianity to a degree, where there was the notion of salvation in the masses, that bodhisattvas were here almost like priests to bring people into the fold and to teach, you know, central truths. He notes, I think correctly, that it's a little too easy to start making these connections when there was already, for that matter, a tendency towards that kind of thinking, even in Hinduism, which predates Christianity by quite a lot. So it's more of a recognition that a lot of, these are all people. And we tend to have tendencies towards, limiting our ideas to make them manageable. So, you know, there are certain aspects, and this is where we get into, like, you know, there are kernels in what Siddhartha, you know, taught that, you know, that because they weren't fully defined, because that's not what he wanted to do, people ran with them later and did their own thing. And that's just a tendency we all have.
Okay. Well, let's see, we've got a few more. Let's see if we can get through a couple more before we need to wrap up. This is a good one. Someone was asking if you could tell us again the name of the series of books that you have behind you that does the short introductions to topics.
It's basically just a very short introduction.
Excellent. They are aptly named then, it sounds like.
It's just, and then you label it. I'm actually on a quest this year to read one a week, which will get me through, I think, all but two or three that I have. So I am not quite keeping up with it, but I'm going to try. So, yeah.
The journey is the important part. You told us that earlier.
It is. Well, and so, yes, are they, actually, some of them do. They have a lot of, for instance, just got done with earlier, the one on the classics. Looking at the, you know, culture of early Greece and Rome, and lots of pictures of just the architecture and how things, you know, flowed back and forth between what the architecture was telling people about the ideas that they were espousing. It's really fascinating. Yeah.
It all being about the path and the climb is a Miley Cyrus song, I believe. Is she a Buddhist?
If it helps her sell tickets, I'm sure she'll say yes.
So, all right, there's a question. Once you strip away all the supernatural elements of Buddhism, what would you say is the essential philosophical argument of it?
I'd say the essential argument is that we enter into the world with a predilection towards unhealthy attachment, and that to reduce it, if not necessarily, get rid of it entirely, one has to engage in behaviors that allow us to recognize that all of this is ephemeral, that it's all going to pass, and that we take and appreciate the joy where we find it, even as it itself will also pass. There's actually a incredible meditative technique that I do not highly recommend to just anybody because it can be a little destabilizing. But is there's a variations on this, but it's meditation on death, where you actively consider the deterioration of your own body and the cessation of your own being, and really getting into just this notion of, right, I, whatever that even means, am going to cease at some point, and that's okay. And it's it's a profoundly freeing moment to have. Yeah,
Okay.
DBT is there are many aspects of DBT that took from some contemplative traditions.
Well, I'm not re used to guests reading the chat and answering directly. I didn't know what you're talking about, but there I see it. Okay. Yes. So I have another timeline question. I often heard that a lot of Jesus's philosophy, or the philosophy attributed to Jesus in the Bible, was because Buddhism had seeped into the Middle East. Is that true? Is the timeline of that work out?
I'm not a not an ideological historian on that. I tend to get very wary of without obviously concrete examples. I mean, the earliest mention of anything reverting related to Buddhism wasn't until the mid to late third century in the West. So odds are no, it wasn't. I mean, there's been some contemplation that, for instance, Paul's writing and was influenced by Eastern thought. Maybe, but there's just, as far as I'm aware, happy to be proven wrong. But as far as I'm aware, there's really no data that backs that up. It's
Okay.
more of a, wow, this is some really in it's almost like what's the idea with evolution where there are
Convergence. Convergent evolution.
I mean, ideologies work the same way. I mean, it's just there are tendencies within the human psyche to go down certain paths, and
Or
it just
also
tends to happen.
possibly we're cherry picking and seeing patterns where there really aren't any, just to match things up.
Just because the cloud looks like a chicken does not mean it actually is one. So, yeah.
All human societies did not learn how to build pyramid-shaped things from aliens, you're saying?
Yes, they did. I see
No.
it on the History Channel. How could they be wrong? It's
I
the
should have read the History
History
Channel,
Channel.
yes. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on that note, okay, no, actually, I do have one final question, David. So, would you say that you consider yourself a Buddhist, or do you just practice elements of Buddhism, or am I asking the wrong question?
I really don't like putting a label on it. No, there are definitely a lot of, I would, if for that poll question, if I had to choose a religion, if I just had to, like somebody like what are you going to do? That would be it. It wouldn't be an issue for me at all. There are aspects of it that are just really, really awful. And for those who want to, you know, the other one around stoicism, the reality is there's a whole lot of overlap between the two. So if you want to jettison, you know, the religious elements, oh, I don't even want to deal with it, just go study the Stoics. You're going to get a lot of the same ideas without, you know, it will come with its own set of baggage, but it won't come with the religious baggage from Buddhism. So, yeah.
Fair enough. I like it.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.